Hey everyone, we want to take a moment to tell you about the sponsor of this podcast, Roosevelt's.
You may know Roosevelt's as the company who makes those rad all over print button downs with just about every franchise that you love.
They of course have Star Wars, because this is a Star Wars podcast, but they also have Harry Potter, Disney, Pixar, Marvel, NASA, WWE, The Office, Nickelodeon, Rick and Morty, Friends, all kinds of other stuff, including new lines from Yellowstone and The Godfather.
And not just button-downs, but t-shirts, they do shorts, jackets, hoodies, koozies, flannels, so many different kinds of items, so many dope designs. So if you're interested in picking something up for the first time, go to rsvlts.com and use promo code THANKTHEMAKER with no spaces to get 20% off your first purchase. Once again, that's rsvlts.com. Use promo code THANKTHEMAKER to get 20% off of your first purchase.
Hello there, and welcome to Thank the Maker, a podcast about heroes, princesses, scoundrels, hokey religions, ancient weapons, and all things Star Wars. I'm Adam Russell.
Hey, I'm Nick Yanbarian.
And I am Dano Flores.
Of the Dano Channel fame. I have to say it every time.
Of the Dano Channel. Yeah.
It just sounds cool to say of blank fame.
What other channel would I be from?
Yeah.
It was meant to be.
I'm not the seasonings guy. Spelled the same. And I did it first, but I'm not the seasonings guy.
If only you were, though.
You know, somebody mailed me a bottle of seasoning the other day.
So much more money.
I know. I'd be rich. I should have made seasonings. I messed up.
Do it anyway. Confuse people.
It's never too late.
You know what you could get into that's seasoning adjacent?
What is that?
Spice.
Mm. Ah, yeah. Very well done.
Yeah.
Always keeping it Star Wars with you. I love
it. Big market for that. Yep. It's funny you say that, keeping it Star Wars, because here we are for the first time ever reviewing specifically... Not just mentioning, not just making jokes about Thank the Maker, a Top Gun podcast or whatever, but we are officially actually doing a non-Star Wars movie review.
Yeah, I'll allow it. Why not?
But there's still going to be some Star Wars crossover.
Yeah.
It's unavoidable.
Yeah, like, it's everywhere.
You have to.
That actor looked exactly like Han Solo, right?
I know. It's interesting, isn't it? It's weird.
I thought he was a little bit better, actually.
It's funny that... I think for most people, and like we're seeing this with all the podcasts and YouTube channels who cover Star Wars or even focus specifically on Star Wars, people have been covering this movie. We're a little late to the party because one, we had other stuff going on with the tours and everything. But two, I feel like unless it is a Star Wars film and we need to give an immediate reaction, like a theatrical release, that's, you know, it's a much bigger deal. I think it's cool to give people time. Mm-hmm. To actually see the thing and not have to go back and listen to, you know, a month old episode or whatever. And there's been a little bit of like critic backlash that's kind of tainted this movie that's done some similar things to it that some Star Wars films and Indiana Jones films have had and other pop culture films have had in the past where I think it's maybe preventing, it's changing people's perception of like the urgency to go see this.
Mm. Yeah. There's a lot of people who haven't seen it.
Like even, you know, two of our hosts, Mike and Ryan, are still just behind the times.
It's interesting, you know. There's time we could, if we want to do it now or later. I mean, just even talking about that and how we talk about releasing things and Disney and Lucasfilm and all this stuff. I mean, we could get into it now or later. You tell me. I have opinions for sure.
Well, let's do maybe something a little different. Instead of going with like first impressions first, what if we do stolen plans at the top here, ending with like the budget and the gross, and we could even talk about those scores, those critic and fan scores, then discuss and get into our first impressions to follow that.
Yep.
Sweet.
What have you done with those plans?
Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny premiered June 30th, 2023, written by several people. I don't remember exactly what the timeline was, but originally Steven Spielberg was directing, so there were other writers. My guess is, it's pretty obvious, David Koepp, who worked on, famously, Jurassic Park, little-known film. That's got to be the Steven Spielberg tie-in, I would assume, without even doing Mission Impossible also, and Toy Soldiers.
Yeah.
One of my favorite, like, deep-cut action movies from the late 80s or maybe 91-ish.
It's a good one.
I have to confess, I thought it was Small Soldiers at first. I was like, wow, you really like Small Soldiers that much? But no, I've actually never seen Toy Soldiers, but I've seen Small Soldiers.
Wait, Toy Soldiers was like the trapped in a school thing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So man. I need to revisit Small Soldiers because I keep seeing it popping up on like VFX breakdowns and stuff because mm-hmm. it was pretty, you know, groundbreaking for the time.
It was a great movie.
But
that's not these people.
So Toy Soldiers is a huge, awesome cast. It's, well, not huge. It for like the 80s, it's huge. It's Will Wheaton, who's kind of the main kid. Mm-hmm. You know, Louis Gossett Jr. I'm going to blank on all the names. Samwise the Brave. What's his freaking name?
Sean Astin.
Sean Astin's in it. You know, like a bunch of those, like, you know, kind of up and coming teens that were in that, like, you know, all the good stuff from back then. It's that cast.
Late 80s.
Yeah. I'm surprised that I haven't thought about that movie in 30 years, probably. I'm surprised I remembered what it was about. But I do remember watching it a lot.
Dude, it's like Die Hard for teenagers.
Yeah, yeah.
It's super sick. And it's hard to find streaming, but it was recently on one service. It's out there. Go look for it. Just buy it. It's sick. back to the writers. Jez Butterworth and John Henry Butterworth, they wrote Edge of Tomorrow and Ford versus Ferrari. Mm. Not a bad couple films.
Yeah.
So there's the James Mangold tie-in. He was also a writer on this. And the director, as we all know, James Mangold being the dude who gave us Logan, like, as far as I'm concerned, the best real-world gritty adaptation of a comic book character.
Oh, yeah.
You guys, is there anything else that you think kind of tops that?
In the world of comics?
No, because I feel like it just really lived in where it needed to live. You know, they didn't really try to make it, you know, more palatable. It's like, no, right. Here's the world we're living in. We're sticking to it. So that's admirable to me.
Yeah. He also wrote, directed Ford versus Ferrari, like we mentioned, Walk the Line, 310 to Yuma, and is writing and directing the upcoming Star Wars sort of like Force origin, Jedi origin story. The one that goes way back, you know, 20,000 years BBY. I think he's going to pull it off.
He could make a movie.
I think he's going to do it, guys.
I don't doubt that.
This was the first indie film neither written by or directed by George Lucas or Steven Spielberg, but they were both executive producers. So
I wonder what that really means, besides them legally needing to be listed as executive producers, probably.
Probably in their contract.
No.
It's like, no, you're going to put our name on there somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. Give us a little bit of money.
It seems like the kind of thing that's that with one caveat, like, you know, if this is really a major stinker, we get to come in and like pull some weight and try to at least slow it down or redirect if need be.
Yeah.
I would guess Spielberg at least still has that pull, you know? Starring, of course, Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones and some different ages. We'll talk about that. Phoebe Waller-Bridge as Helena Shaw, a.k.a. Wombat. She's Wombat to me. That's the name. Sorry, that's it. She played L3 in Solo. She did the suit work with the green screen suit and, you know, the kind of like a droid parts overlay. We talked about that in the behind the scenes. Probably seen that. She's also the creator, writer, producer, and star of one of the best drama shows I've seen in the past 10 years, Fleabag, on Amazon Prime. Have you guys seen it?
I've not.
It's on my list.
It is great. I've probably talked about it before on the show, but it's one of the best, like, kind of tonal shift things that doesn't really take you by surprise. It just kind of organically goes through it. And by the end, you're like, oh my God, how did we get here? This is incredible. This is one of the best things I've ever seen.
Yeah, that's rad.
She's just so good. And all the wit that we know from this role and her as L3, it's like purely her own in Fleabag. Mm-hmm. And it's just beautiful. She's brilliant. Unreal. I'm so glad. We'll talk about this at the very end, but she to me is maybe the only person on the planet that can hang with Harrison Ford in terms of wit and that, like, there's like a physicality that she has too. And she just has a lot of the qualities that makes her kind of the only one.
Yeah, I really enjoyed her in this movie. I really, if I'm going to give like anything an A+ in this movie, it's her character.
Agreed. Let's see. Mads Mikkelsen as Dr. Jürgen Völler, AKA Dr. Schmidt. We know him, of course, as Galen Erso from Rogue One. He was also the villain in Casino Royale, which I think was the first time I saw him. He starred in the Hannibal series as Hannibal Lecter, and he was also in Doctor Strange, but I don't remember who in Doctor Strange.
Yeah, he was like the main baddie.
Yeah.
The first Doctor Strange, I believe.
Also an awesome movie, but for whatever reason, I didn't commit that to memory. Ethan Isidore, that's going to be my guess on the pronunciation, as Teddy, Wombat's little sidekick. young kid. He's a French actor, French Brazilian. He's been in a few French productions, things I didn't recognize, but, you know, international films, most likely in French, I would guess. I thought he was great. Toby Jones as Basil Shaw. He's Dr. Zola in Captain America, the first one. Also, Claudius Temple Smith in The Hunger Games, like one of the council or whatever, people with all the hair. He's one of those dudes. Boyd Holbrook as the neo-Nazi Kleber. He was in Logan. Also played the, like one of the military dudes in Shane Black's 2008 The Predator reboot or whatever you want to call that. Not my favorite movie, to be honest.
He's the like not Brad Pitt guy.
Right. He's like the Brad Pitt that you get from like Big Lots or like the dollar store.
Yeah. I wish.
Yeah. I'd be happy to be that version of Brad Pitt.
I like to think that I am.
That's what we have to say. That's how I describe you.
So are you Big Lots or the dollar store? Because I'll take the other one.
Wish. I'm definitely the Wish version.
Wish.com. Got it.
Wish.com, yeah.
Seanette Renee Wilson as the CIA agent Mason. She was Stephanie Reed in 7 episodes of Billions on Showtime, show I haven't seen, but I've heard great things about. And she was also a member of that all-female Wakandan Special Forces unit.
Oh, the Dora Milaje.
There you go. There's the pronunciation, which I was scared to do, in Black Panther. And then out of nowhere, I didn't see the whole cast for this, Antonio Banderas pops up as Indy's ship captain / diver frogman friend, Ronaldo.
Yeah. I loved seeing him. I love seeing him in anything. Jesus,
yeah.
So I was very stoked to be like...
It took me longer than it should have. It was one of those things where I'm just like, who's that? That's familiar. It's a familiar person.
Yeah,
it took me a second too.
I was and like, wait like, a minute.
Definitely took me a couple seconds. I'm like, it's Antonio Banderas. And I feel like that's a little weird.
Yeah, it was weird. Like, it was such a cool surprise though. I was like, what? Yeah. What are you doing here?
Dude, what a testament to the size and cultural impact of this franchise that a dude of his age is like, screw it, I'll play some tiny support character. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Put me in.
Yeah.
You know? It also took me a while because it's been a long time since I've seen him in something and he's so much older and he had that like gritty look. I was like, who's that man under all that?
That's how you do it. Like, so it doesn't take away from the story, but you still like kind of recognize him, but it's not like, oh my God, that's Antonio Banderas. Right. That's all I can think about.
Yeah.
You can still think about the story.
And reprising their roles from earlier indie movies, John Rhys-Davies as Sala, you know, for a brief moment, a couple brief moments, and Karen Allen as Marion Ravenwood.
Sala's kids were a confusing age to me.
Oh, he keeps banging them out.
I assume he's the same age as Indy,
no,
right?
Dude, Sala fucks.
Yeah, clearly.
Those kids were like 10.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that means he's had a kid when he was like 70. Because
you heard it here first.
I mean, how old is Indiana Jones supposed to be? I know Harrison Ford's like 80.
I think he's supposed to be 70-ish more in this one. I forgot to do the math, but I did hear it mentioned that he was younger. Yeah. Sala's either just fully just like...
very fertile.
The sperm donor of the Middle East.
Very fertile.
Or he's like going like, you know, Brad and Angelina style, just adopting any kid he can get his hands on for non-nefarious purposes. And the score by supposedly the last one, the retirement score, the legendary John Williams. Budget on this film was $294 million, almost $295. This is an estimate. Which is like, honestly, less than I expected. I don't know. It's shot all around the world. It's Indiana Jones. They switch directors in the middle of the thing. I don't know. I was figuring like $500 million.
De-aging can't be cheap the way it was done.
Yeah, that's true.
At the time of this recording, globally, it has grossed $357.
Oh.
So
Bob Iger's like, can we close something else? We got the Star Cruiser already. What else could we close?
Yeah, how do we shut down Indiana Jones?
Close the ride at Disneyland.
Can we sell him? Can he be a write-off?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder how much of this is...
That's worldwide, too. It's not good.
Yeah. Well, last thing I'll say before we get into this. 2 hour and 34 minute runtime, which was good. Yeah. It could have maybe been 10 minutes shorter, but it didn't feel long to me, per se.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, I appreciate it. I saw that like middle chase scene when they're on that, whatever you want to call it, that little
tuk-tuk.
I saw that entire scene at Celebration.
Oh, well.
So I got up and peed during that.
Nice.
I really appreciated that.
Nice.
I was like, I know how long this is, and it's pretty long. So I'm going to go just stroll, take a whiz.
Yeah, I definitely picked one of the half a dozen different set pieces in the global chase for a pee break on my second viewing.
Yeah.
All right, so this discussion about what it's grossing right now, what it opened at, I think it was like $61 million or something opening weekend, which is not what you expect.
Mm-hmm.
Don't quote me on that, but it was low.
60.
60?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, ouch.
So I remember, like, I told Ryan Key I was going to see it because we were planning on seeing it together on tour. And I was like, look, dude, I can't wait a whole week. I'm going. Sorry. I'm stoked. People are saying good things. And he's like, yeah, I wish the ratings were better and the reviews. And I was like, what? He watches that stuff closely. He like lives by that Rotten Tomatoes score, which I'm the complete opposite. I try to avoid it. Like, as far as I'm concerned, Little Nicky's 100% fresh, you know, like I'm that kind of dude. But he's like, oh yeah, man. So I've been watching it and it's kind of, it's like, it's creeping back up on the fan score, but I think the critics just hit it hard and I don't know why.
Yeah. I don't know what did they say?
I haven't read any of them because I just can't
bring
that
really
energy into my life. But
yeah, I mean, I feel an absolute general malaise with it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think people rushed to see it. And now that it's been out for a little over a month, we're still having people who should see it who haven't seen it. Plus, whenever anyone asked me, I was like, yeah, it was good.
Yeah.
You know, and like, that's not a good review to be like, yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
But that's how I feel. I think it was a very down the middle, kind of afraid to take risks sort of movie. And I think that that's where I'll just get into bashing Disney a little bit. I feel like that's where they're at. I think they're afraid to take risks. And taking risks might make the box office plummet, and then being safe might make the box office plummet. So I don't know what their plan is moving forward.
Yeah, I don't envy their position as the biggest entertainment company in Earth's history.
Part of it's got to be that bad taste in people's mouths left after Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Yeah, for sure.
That kind of explains why they're a little afraid to take risks. Because the last time they did, and it was supposed to be Indy's last movie, it kind of, I don't know, it didn't do very well at all. I don't hate Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. I enjoy it for what it is, all its goofiness.
It's half a good movie.
Right. I mean, but it's Indy. It's goofy. You're going to get weird.
Right. It's campy as hell.
Yeah. Yeah. So for that reason, I like it. But yeah, I think that kind of left a bad taste in people's mouths, or at least the perception of it was that, like, okay, maybe we don't go too crazy, but we go for a comfortable, safe send-off of Indy with this movie. Yeah. And I agree with you with that review of, it was good. That's exactly what I would tell someone. I was like, no, it was good, but that's it.
Yeah, and if someone said that to me, I wouldn't be like, well, I'm off to see it right now. You know, like, it's kind of, that's a big issue, I think. I mean, this is when it comes to Adam, when, you know, Bayside's writing songs or you guys are writing songs or whatever, it's like, you really can't just hand people the like 30th easy song to listen to that sounds exactly like everything else you've done.
Right.
It's just in one ear and out the other. It's just not how things work. So I think this suffered from that a little bit because I don't know what else it could be. There's no other competition movie-wise. You know, like Oppenheimer and Barbie came out a month later. Marketing, I saw it everywhere. So I can't blame marketing. It's really hard to see. I know the movie theater going crowd hasn't recovered from COVID. I know that much, you know, like that, the just in general movies have not, I mean, entertainment in general hasn't bounced back. I mean, there's a strike right now partially because of that stuff. So I don't know. But then things like Mission Impossible and Top Gun crush. So you need Tom Cruise in your movie. Tom Cruise should have played Indiana Jones. All right.
Yeah.
Wrap it up. That's the episode.
Yeah. I don't know what the answer is either, because the points you guys are making about taking risks or not and it being a lose-lose, like either way, it's a big roll of the dice. What do you do with that? Like, and I don't think Indiana Jones is the franchise to go making a hard left turn into something different. And I think the only, like, not a critique, but like the only answer to that question that I would offer, I think this could have had one fewer chase set piece, five fewer characters, and a little more like just slowed down puzzle solving, or, you know, that classic, you know, discussion in the library kind of like exposition thing, mm-hmm. to slim down the movie.
Yeah.
I think that's it. And because the end, like some of those big set pieces are such like giant CG fests. I think a lot of people perceive that as like the same way they perceive the Marvel thing, even though as far as I'm concerned, there was so much more substance in those than the average, like, you know, superhero versus supervillain punch fest. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think something I heard months ago from a highly credible source who I don't think would say anything if they didn't know it to be true, but I had heard that the movie, the ending of the movie, was testing poorly. And I think there's a high, strong possibility that there's a different ending out there that's on the cutting room floor now. And knowing that going in...
Allegedly, there are several.
Yeah. So I don't you think... Are we in spoiler territory? Or we're not yet, right?
Not
I think
yet.
There's
a
cut point.
I want to talk to some more.
You could see. Yeah, I think there's a cut point at the end where you could see where it was just like, this is what happens, and then we have to pick the ending.
Yeah.
There's like a very direct cut point where it literally goes to black for a second, and it's like, insert ending here. So I that's... And it seemed like it was going in another direction. I don't think that was a total writing of a fake out where, you know, we'll get to the spoilers later, but it seems like it was heading in a direction and then it didn't. But I don't think that was a fake out. I think that there's a version of it that keeps heading in that direction.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Well, do you guys want to give like deeper first reactions? Do you have more to say, or can I ask you a question about Indiana Jones in general?
That was it.
Or maybe you could, you know, I'll ask the question, and if that precipitates some more feelings about this film, then so be it. So, Dano, as the guest, go first. What's your relationship with Indiana Jones? Like, how far back does it go for you? What was the first one you saw? How old were you? Where does it kind of sit in your pop culture worldview?
So, for Indiana Jones, the first time I really recall seeing it was when I was about 8 or 9 years old. My parents had one of those illegal cable boxes that you could watch whatever channel only on their TV. So I would go into their room and like watch stuff like HBO, you know, the premium channels. And during the day, like middle of the day, I remember catching just from the middle, Temple of Doom, and seeing the whole like beating heart, Kali Ma thing.
You said you were 8 years old?
I was 8 or 9. I think I might've been like 9.
Brutal.
And that's pretty intense to see as a kid.
Yeah,
and I knew I shouldn't have been watching it, but I was like just by myself watching it. And I'm like, what is this? This is the coolest thing ever. And so with that, I didn't even realize it was Indiana Jones, but I didn't realize until later when I was older and like sat and watched all the movies. But I do remember seeing it as a kid and being like, that is cool. This whole movie in the jungle, all this stuff is awesome. But at the same time, I was into a lot of cartoons like Nicktoons, and you would see stuff like on Doug, he would do a parody of Indiana Jones, or you'd see on Rugrats, they would do their own parodies of Indiana Jones. It existed everywhere. It was such a pop culture thing that even if you hadn't seen Indiana Jones, you knew the references, you know, with the big ball chasing, you know. So I hadn't seen Raiders of the Lost Ark at the time, but I'd known about that ball, or I'd seen on Disney Channel the stunt spectacular from Hollywood Studios Park, and had seen that stuff when it showed up on Full House or when it showed up on all these other things. So my relationship with Indiana Jones really first was all of those other shows referencing it, and me having seen as a really little kid Temple of Doom somewhat, but not knowing what it was. And it wasn't until I was a older teen, probably about 17 or 18, that I found the trilogy at a thrift store like Savers on VHS for a couple bucks, and I bought it. And I sat down and watched them all for the first time on VHS as an older teen, almost adult. And that's when I really, really got into them. And I was fortunate to go to a couple like dollar movie theaters when they do midnight showings of Raiders of the Lost Ark and get to see them in these like gritty old, you know, soda encrusted seat theaters and get the real true experience. And so since then, I've absolutely loved them. And when Crystal Skull came out, I had to see it opening day. I've been like, oh, this is going to be great. We're getting our first new indie in such a long time. And I was like, okay, well, that was fine. It was okay. Like, I get it. I was like, that was okay. I wasn't mad at it, but I was like, that's okay. And so I was excited for this one. I was like, okay, we're getting a redo. We're getting another last shot at Indiana Jones. This is going to be the last one with Harrison Ford. I don't imagine they're going to squeeze out another one, given how long this one took to make. And so I was pretty excited for it, but I also felt like, all right, this is their safe send off. And yeah, that's my quick little relationship to indie.
Nick, how about you?
My relationship's absolutely, obviously intertwined with Star Wars, and everything I've ever said about Return of the Jedi being my favorite absolutely applies to Temple of Doom, because that's where I found it. That's the one I watched a million times when I was a kid. And pretty parallel to how people think about Return of the Jedi being like the third best of the original trilogy, people think that Temple of Doom is the third best of the original trilogy. And I see my entrance into Star Wars and Indiana Jones as why I like those movies the most. So I'd say basically the same thing. So like where like Temple of Doom is my favorite, but I know Last Crusade's a better movie.
Don't spoil the whole thing yet.
You know.
Don't give you your full ranking.
I know. So yeah, I mean, I loved it just like I loved anything else when I was a kid. I just fully believed the universe it lived in. It was so much fun. They seemed separate to me, even though Harrison Ford was Han Solo in Indiana Jones. Yeah. I never really connected the two. I don't even know if I, growing up, that I knew George Lucas had anything to do with Indiana Jones.
Right.
I don't even know if I knew George Lucas did Star Wars when I was a kid. You know, like I really didn't care about that stuff. It was about having fun watching and playing with toys. So I enjoyed it. It was never anything. It was nowhere near the same level of fandom for me as Star Wars was.
I'm in the same boat in terms of like ranking Star Wars and in Indiana Jones, but it's in my, as far as like franchises go, it's in my top five for sure. It's Star Wars, Back to the Future, Indiana Jones, Terminator, you know, which really is two films as far as I'm concerned. But it's way up there. And I had the exact same feeling, Nick, where Han Solo and Indiana Jones were two distinct different people, even though it was obviously the same actor, even before I knew things about actors. And that's like such a credit to the writing, to the character writing. And I even as like a young adult sort of like articulated that to myself. And I remember talking about it in this exact same way. So it persisted even as I became aware that this is obviously the same dude. And part of why it's so, these characters are so good is because how he embodies them. But it's just like a beautiful testament again to the story. The story, the screenwriting, the character development, the world building. So Indiana Jones has always been a huge part of my life. But I think the earliest one I remember watching for real all the way through, because I did have similar moments where like my dad was watching Temple of Doom and he would cover my eyes or make me leave the room when it got really gnarly, it was The Last Crusade. So I was 9 when that came out. That was prime time for me to start like really discovering movies. I don't think I saw it in a theater, like a normal theater first, but I definitely saw it, and I've mentioned this before, at a drive-in theater. It was a double feature. I'm pretty sure it was like Hot Shots Part 2 and Indiana Jones. I fell asleep at some point during one of them, but I don't think it was Indy. I think I watched the whole thing. And my like deepest connection, my most rewatched is for sure The Last Crusade. And there's a lot of nostalgia wrapped up in it, being, you know, like a father-son story. My dad died when I was younger. So it's very close to my heart. So that's kind of like my core indie like worldview. And I've seen Raiders tons. I've probably seen Temple of Doom the same number of times. And I really respect them and different strengths. You know, they have their different strengths and whatever. And I understand like the cultural impact of Raiders. But like timing-wise, when I was a kid, it was just like Return of the Jedi, like you're saying, in terms of older people, you know, having their criticisms and us not understanding that at all, was so much timing. So it's interesting to go back and we'll see like in our rankings and how we talk about that, where they place for all of us, because, you know, I think we can step back as like 40-ish year old people and be more objective. But I just like Star Wars, I don't remember a time before Indiana Jones in my life.
Yeah, absolutely.
That pretty much sums it up. And lastly, I'll say before we get into this overview, I completely love this movie. The first viewing, I saw it with Bon on tour, and we both came out and went, yeah, that was really good. Yeah, cool. Yeah, like much happier than Crystal Skull. But the second viewing the other day, I loved, like loved it. Have you guys seen it again or just the once?
No, I haven't.
One time.
It was easily twice as good, if not five times better, the second viewing. Mm-hmm. I really, really teared up, of course, when the first Indian Marion theme hit, when he was telling the story about Mutt dying. That got me. And then the final scene, dude. Woo, bro. I Star Wars ugly cried through that part. So I would go see it again in the theater if you guys can before it's out.
Yeah, I plan on it. I mean, I think in general, if I have any advice for anyone, when you are going to see a reboot or a sequel or anything of your, you know, one of your favorite things, I would almost like not even pay attention the first time.
Yeah.
You know, like I just threw on Futurama's back. Futurama's one of my favorite shows, and only two episodes have been out so far. And I've watched both of them the first time with my phone in my hand, like kind of paying attention, mm-hmm. just being like, I can't put this under a microscope right now.
Yeah.
It's like this little hack where I'm just like, expectations sometimes are hard to level off. Sometimes you just have to like, yeah, I'll watch this, whatever.
Yeah.
And you watch it out of the corner of your eye. It's just this little hack where it's like, watch it for real the second time.
Yeah.
Just go in and distract yourself and whatever. Movie theater is obviously different. You can't really distract yourself, but expectations are a bitch. We say it so many times on this show, and it's one little thing that I've learned to do, especially with music. A new Jenny Lewis song comes out, a new Bad Religion song comes out, I just throw it on and go on with my day and listen to it, kind of.
Yeah.
And then once it's once over, twice over, then I could be like, okay, what do I really think? Let me sit here and actually listen to it or watch it.
Yeah, I had like a really similar thing with The Force Awakens, and I talked about it on that first episode of this podcast. I had like anxiety the whole time. Like the second Han Solo came on screen, I was like, oh my God, is he doing it right? Is he doing Han okay? Is he pulling it off? Does Chewie look right? I was just analyzing it so hard. And luckily that movie turned out to be incredible and it was all fine. But it was the second viewing where I could really relax and enjoy it. And this was that for sure. And I want to correct myself before we move forward. Surprisingly, the part that made me ugly cry was the conversation, you know, we're pre-spoilers still, the conversation between Indy and the important character that we didn't expect to meet towards the very end before the cut to black.
Yeah.
That conversation with Wombat in the mix too, like, oh, dude, bro, that got me. And then the Marion thing was just like, it just kept going, you know? And I know we're talking about spoilers with Marion showing up, but that's all out there. So if you've waited this long, you're bad. So let's get into a quick overview. I don't want to do like a full synopsis because it's just going to take way too long. And we're already like 35 minutes into this thing. So this starts with a really long prologue. It's like 45 minutes. This is Indy with his friend and fellow archaeologist Basil Shaw escaping from Nazi captivity. This is during actual World War II. I don't remember the year, but they find Archimedes' dial during this escape. It's on a train. It's called the Antikythera, I think is like one of the half a dozen pronunciations I've heard for this thing. They're looking for a different artifact, but then they find this. They escape with it. They think they've killed all the Nazis in the situation. We then jump forward to 1969. Indy is a soon-to-retire professor at Hunter University in New York City. He's all old and washed up. The world is changing around him. Music and pop culture is different. There's this sick Beatles needle drop in his apartment that he wakes up shirtless to go give him the old, turn out that music kind of thing. Astronauts are landing on the moon. There's kids in space helmets. Like, the whole world is looking to the future instead of the past, which he cares about. He's an antique. He's a relic. He's become the very thing he sought to put in museums. One of the best juxtapositions, or like kind of like just turning the thing on its head moments, is in Raiders, how it opened with him lecturing to a class of students who totally adored him. This girl with, you know, I love you written on her eyelids, in love with him. Now everyone's just falling asleep in his class. They couldn't care less about what he's saying. Everything's way different. So Helena Shaw shows up. aka Wombat, his goddaughter, daughter of Basil, his old friend who has since died. Great name for Helena, by the way, being like an ancient name. It's kind of perfect. She's also looking for the dial, but she wants to sell it on the black market. She's all about the money. She's disillusioned by Indy having disappeared from her life years ago. She does a little bait and switch on him. It turns into this whole thing. And there's a really cool, like, dynamic conflict between them. She also has a sidekick named Teddy, which we talked about earlier. There's a Nazi from the prologue who we thought was dead, played by Mads Mikkelsen. He returns with these neo-Nazi henchmen in tow. He's since been working for the U.S. government as part of what we assume to be, is it called Operation Paperclip? Or we'll talk about this later. It's in the den. Working for the U.S. government on rockets and weapons and space program. This is very much an homage to, like, Wernher von Braun, and it's good stuff. So Mads is under working under a pseudonym. He's trying to get the dial because he wants to use it to go back in time. The idea of the dial is that it's not a time machine, but it's like a map to fissures in space and time that happen naturally. And if you can find those, you can travel through time. He wants to go back to 1939, exactly 30 years back, because he wants to kill Hitler, because he insists that Hitler lost the war. The Allies didn't beat the Nazis. It was Hitler's fault. He sucked. He's going to go take his place. That's the idea. So Indy and Wombat only have half the dial. Archimedes broke it in two pieces and separated them to protect it. A global chase ensues, like we talked about, involving a ton of classic Indiana Jones puzzle solving, tomb raiding, and for the first time, shipwreck diving with eels as the stand-in for snakes. That's good. They find the other half. The Nazis get a hold of it. So Indy, Wombat, and Teddy pursue. The chase ends in Sicily with a plane chase. Indy as a prisoner in the Nazi plane, Wombat as a stowaway in that plane, and Teddy chasing them in another small plane. They go through the fissure in time, but as they're doing this, Indy points out continental drift was not calculated. It wasn't something that was known at the time of Archimedes, of course. So it wasn't accounted for, and they're not going to end up in Europe. They're going to end up right where they are in Italy. They end up coming through, and they go back to BCE times during the siege of Syracuse at the exact time and location where Archimedes is working on the dial. The Nazi plane crashes. They all die. There's a bunch of chaos, of course. It's a great little battle. But Indy and Wombat end up rushing to the same spot as Archimedes where this plane crashed. They speak to him in ancient Greek. It's just perfect. Like there's all this setup, like four movies of setup. Like, of course they would know the language and they would talk to this guy. Like, it's just incredible. Like you even go back to, sorry, I'm in the synopsis, but you go back to like the prologue of The Last Crusade when he runs in as a kid into his dad's office, Indy, and he makes him stop and count to 10 and he makes him do it in Latin. So it's like, he's been like teaching this kid from birth to prepare him for a moment like this, whether or not he knew it. It's just brilliant. Indy wants to stay there. He's wounded. He's like, screw it. I spent my whole life studying this. Just let me die here. Wombat says, no way. Punches him out. There's the cut to black that we talked about. Indy wakes up in his apartment. Wombat's there. Marion and Sala show up. There's a big happy ending. There's a throwback to Raiders. And there's no post credits. It just ends. And damn, I love it. End of synopsis.
I wasn't expecting, of all the things I didn't expect, his hat hanging on that like clothesline or whatever at the end. I was like, oh, he hung his hat up as you do when you're done with something.
Yeah.
And then he grabs it again. I'm like, why'd you have to just leave it there?
Yeah.
Grabbing it implies there's more adventure.
It does.
But he always grabs it though. That's like his thing, is grabbing the hat at the last second. True. Like that's
reaching under the door, all the.
Yeah, that's the indie thing. Like, oh, he's got to grab it.
Okay.
Like,
okay. You talked me into it. I take it back.
It sprinkles some breadcrumbs to say, like, maybe we'll go down that path, but then you could come back with exactly what you said, Dano, and go, no, they're not doing that. It's okay. Like, they get the best of both by doing
it. Yeah. I mean, that is so much of a thing that there's a moment in one of the Simpsons intros that is a parody of Indiana Jones that Bart loses his hat under the garage door as it's closing, and he reaches out to grab it.
Yeah.
Like, it's that much of an Indiana Jones thing that they put it in the Simpsons.
Yeah, it's... Again, like the thing you guys mentioned, it's just such a part of the cultural zeitgeist. I knew the ball rolling thing too. Like I knew all that stuff before I saw those movies because it's almost, at least for Americans, like I would love to see a survey of like how the casual viewer who's not a super fan of either franchise how well they know each one, you know, like if they're on par. Mm-hmm. One other thing I want to mention that we said briefly before, Mutt Williams, right?
Yeah.
Is the name, his son that he had with Marion that we, he was played by Shia LaBeouf, who we met in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. He has since died. There's a nice little moment where it's a nice like character turning point for Wombat or Helena connecting with Indy and kind of changing her tune from this just like all for the money kind of character to someone who sees like the emotional connection and the story of her life kind of through what Indy's going through. He talks about how he got divorced from, well, the question is, what would you do if you could go back in time? What would you change? And he said he would tell his son not to join the military, not to go to war, because he would tell him that if he did, he would die, and his mother would be inconsolable, and she would blame Indy for it, and it would destroy their marriage. It's heavy, dude. Like, mm-hmm. talk about like a real time put into retconning the absence of a character from a movie that kind of flopped.
Yeah.
I haven't seen many movies where they put that much care into it. I had a lot of respect for it and thought it was great.
It's a different outcome with the son, but literally the first thing I said walking out of that movie to the people I was with was, that's the same thing that happened to Han and Leia.
Yeah. Yeah. Dude.
Yeah.
The first takeaway was me bringing it back to Star Wars. So I'm like, Harrison Ford, man, he lost his son to the dark side and now lost his son in a war.
Yeah.
And made the marriage fall apart.
Yeah. He's really good at playing kind of like a lovable shitbag, you know? Maybe he just is a lovable shitbag in real life. You know, he's just playing himself. Better pilot on screen, though, than in real life.
Oof. Yeah.
Shots fired, my bad. He's an old man. Anything else we want to touch on before we get into the Den of Antiquities? Because there's a bunch of fun discussion in that.
I don't know if it's time or place, but that opening scene, you know, that you mentioned was fairly long, looked amazing. And the whole time I'm watching it, I'm way too analytical and I'm like, Harrison Ford could never die.
Yeah.
Like, if it looks this good, he could just never die. Like, don't, like, make more Indiana Jones. And then slippery slope, you know, like, no new actors ever. Yeah. Something like, you know, something bad could happen. So I was so distracted by how good it looked and the technology that, I mean, I followed the story and I liked it at the beginning, but it looked so good and it just had my mind racing about just do more Indiana Jones or what does this mean for anybody else, any other older actors who have had a career, you know, as long as Harrison Ford. I don't really know what the answer is. I think I would rather it not. And I feel like with AI and all this stuff, if there are no rules and laws in place, our life, the rest of our lifetime is going to be real weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I watched a behind the scenes thing, a few behind the scenes thing, and they talked about the aging specifically in one of them, and they showed Harrison in the scenes with the dots all over his face, and it looks like they were vague about it again, but it looks like they used another combination of traditional face tracking with markers and deepfake technology, and I had the same thoughts. It was so well done, like maybe the best ever.
Oh yeah.
And I think part of that credit goes to Harrison, who seemed to be all in on it. It didn't seem like an old guy who's like, oh, I guess they're going to do this to my face. You know, he seemed to really be invested, not only in his performance, like physically and going for it, but his voice. Like he talked about how he can still, with a little more energy, bring back that higher register voice. Because that's the thing. I didn't even think about the voice. It was so spot on that it didn't even cross my mind.
Yeah. Yeah, it didn't sound like Luke.
Right.
Where they it sounded more real. It was definitely better. Did you notice that? So there were two stand-ins for Harrison, and one of them is that Anthony and Gruber dude who everyone is like, Anthony and Gruber should have just played Han Solo.
Yeah, I had that in the Den, yeah.
You know, and I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah, he was like a stand-in and not, as far as I can tell, not like a straight-up stunt double, but like for just more physical stuff if they... If they had to track the face on, I guess he looks enough like him that it probably made it easier. Mm. But that dude, he was in a movie called The Age of Adeline, where he literally played the younger version of Harrison Ford next to Harrison Ford in that film. And I don't remember the plot of it specifically. I kind of watched it in the background while Jill was watching it. But I want to go back and rewatch because it is uncanny, like insane. And I think he was just an actor who, you know, also had a YouTube channel as young actors do. And he was kind of known for doing great Harrison Ford impersonations.
Yeah.
And that kind of got him a start. That led to Age of Adeline, and that led to an audition for Solo. But ultimately, they went with Alden for whatever reason.
And Alden's in Oppenheimer, and I'm like, that's Han Solo. Yeah.
And he's great. He's great in it. Like, he's better in that than he is in Solo. Not to say that he's bad in Solo, but yeah, good on him. Good shit. Anything else? Any other thoughts? Oh, the only thing about the de-aging, the only moments where it got a little weird for me, and I think it's only because I was analyzing, was as light would kind of pass by his face. You know, he was mostly in the dark, and like a flashlight would come by when they're interrogating, or, you know, train lights. It got a little squirrely to my eyes, but yeah.
No. Which is why those scenes are fully in the dark.
Yeah.
You know, we've progressed to making it look really good in the dark.
I mean, that's where it all started with Spielberg knowing to hide the crimes in the shadows with the dinosaurs. All right, shall we do the Den of Antiquities and talk about some Easter eggs? And I broke this up differently, and I'll tell you in a second. You guys ready for that?
Let's do it.
Let's party.
For over 1,000 generations.
It is the Darksaber. Togosh.
It's a Kalikori.
A Sith wayfinder.
Dark science. Cloning. Secrets only the Sith knew.
Den of Antiquities. Typically, we do Easter eggs and callbacks, references, and fun stuff like that. But we also threw in, I kind of split these up, some real life facts, because this is a movie about archaeology and it's referencing real life stuff that I want to talk about. And then time travel, because there's some implications for the story, and there's some circular stuff that's fun to notice. And there's also a choice when you do time travel in a movie, what philosophy you want to go with, because there are huge paradoxes involved, obviously. So you kind of have to pick a lane, and they did with this one. So I want to talk about it. So right at the top, same typeface for the title cards as the original Raiders. They did not do that in Temple of Doom. They went with the big logo style, if I remember correctly. And then they did return to it in Last Crusade. I don't remember Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, but they went with the classic on this.
I think it is.
Yeah. It's that kind of the font with, it's almost like it's an outline font. I think it's classy. It's classic. Typically, we at the beginning of these movies do a crossfade from the Paramount logo to a mountain or something else, or like a prairie dog hill in Crystal Skull. We didn't do that with Paramount here, I think just because the way Disney has a stronghold on everything, and this is very much a Lucasfilm film production first. So instead, they went with a crossfade from the Lucasfilm logo to the lock on that door in the train. Worked well. You know, it's not as...
Yeah, it was like a perfect fit.
Yeah.
It looked good.
It's not like a super interesting shape, but it still transitioned perfectly. There's a car motorcycle chase in this prologue that, to me, felt a lot... It felt like it was a fast version of the slow-speed tank chase in Last Crusade. You know, combining with the train chase from the prologue of The Last Crusade as well, there's a moment when, like, they're moving the car closer to, or the motorcycle closer to the car next to it, and a dude gets knocked off, just like when they move the tank closer to the wall. There's, you know, jumping back and forth. It was really similar in that sense. Maybe that's just me. It could just be a classic trope, but it was rhyming.
It's tropey.
To my mind. Photos and artwork in Indy's apartment. Did you guys notice a few of these, or did you catch them on some behind the scenes stuff, breakdowns?
Yeah, more so when I watch like breakdowns. Yeah. I was like, oh, okay. Yeah.
So around his apartment, there are a few things on the wall. There's a framed drawing. It looks to be the same drawing from the Grail Diary, but it's bigger, that Henry Jones Sr. drew of the Leap of Faith. You know, you've got the Templar Knight walking across the canyon that ended up being the optical illusion. There's that. Then there's a painting, like an oil painting with... I forgot, was it Joseph of Arimathea who actually catches the blood of Christ in the Grail? Do you guys remember this?
I don't know who it is. But
I know the image, but I don't
so
know.
So it's a color oil painting in that very like medieval style or whatever. catching Jesus's blood in the Grail. That was something that was also hanging in Henry Jones Sr.'s house in the prologue of Last Crusade. That's on his wall. And then there are also photos in frames around of Mutt, Marion, and Henry Jones Sr., played by James Bond himself. There was a whip versus guns moment in the black market artifact auction. Did you guys catch that parallel?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so like a reversal of the gun versus sword moment in Raiders, where Indy, in this case, is the one who's outgunned. It was good. Let's see. Helena makes a reference to, well, it's a foreshadowing. She does a card trick where, I think they're on the boat, right? Mm-hmm. She does a card trick where she does the kind of thing where she sort of suggests which card. She kind of forces the person who's being tricked to pick that card just by suggestion. And the idea is that the future's already been written. It's circular. Like there's like a destiny to the trick. And that's just a little homage, a little foreshadowing for the whole concept of time travel and where this goes. Should have said spoilers at the top of this, huh? So you guys mentioned the tuk-tuk car chase in Tangier. So Indy ultimately loses the villains. Is it the boyfriend in the villains?
Yeah, fiance or something like that. Yeah.
Well, I thought we could have lost those guys.
Yeah, they weren't necessary to any of it.
I mean, it did like
okay. Punctuate. Kick the ball forward a little bit.
Yeah, like, hey, she's like a manizer to Indy's womanizer kind of vibe.
But in general, it's like, I just met her. I definitely don't care about her fiance, you know?
Just kind of too many pieces on the deck.
Yeah.
Did I just mix? I don't know, games. Anyway, so there's the chase, and they're in the little tuk-tuk, the little like three-wheel motorcycle thing, and they go down this narrow alley, and it keeps getting narrower to the point where the tuk-tuk goes through, but the car can't fit, and it gets stuck, and it stops. And although this is like almost definitely just, well, it's obviously like a trope that goes back all the way to silent films and old cartoons and everything. I feel like it's a direct callback to the boat chase in The Last Crusade, where the big boats are closing in, the little boat gets wedged, and it blows up.
Yeah, yeah.
Here's something that, Nick, I thought of you with this. Indy shooting the Nazi that's hanging from Helena's leg while she's dangling out of the plane during the siege of Syracuse, right? Mm-hmm. He's pointing the gun at the dude, just barely over her, and she's got this look on her face like, oh my God, what are you doing? And all I could hear in my head was, just a little higher, a little higher. Yeah. You know, Lando and the Sarlacc pit.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me interject, and I cannot substantiate this at all. I haven't seen it online at all. I have to see the movie again. When the plane goes through the like fissure in time and it starts to fail for a second, I only saw the movie once and I could have sworn I heard like the sound bite of the Millennium Falcon, dying. Is it in there? Because I haven't seen a lot of people bring it up as an Easter egg, and it's a perfect Easter egg if so.
What's great about it is it's like a full circle Easter egg, because that Millennium Falcon sample is actually the sound of a prop plane stalling mixed with some other shit. So
yeah,
pretty perfect.
Makes sense.
Dude, the layers. Jesus. Like the full circle plot and all the story. That's awesome. Well done, sir. Let's see. This is a little one. Towards the beginning of the movie, Indy, he's in his kitchen. He's all bummed out. There's a picture of Marion on the refrigerator. He grabs a bigger magnet than the one that's holding it up and just puts it over her face. Like he's just blocking it out. He's bummed out. At the end of the movie, when she shows up, she's in the kitchen. She's brought groceries and she's putting them in the fridge. So as she opens it and goes in there, he behind her back moves the magnet off of her face. Yeah, so she doesn't see that he had done that.
Cheeky
bugger. In the final scene with Indy and Marion also, this is the last of kind of these little Easter eggs here. Indy says, everything hurts. And Marion says, I know how that feels. And Indy asks, well, where doesn't it hurt? This is a straight up callback to what leads to the sex scene, the off-screen sex scene in Raiders, when it's the exact opposite conversation. And Indy says, well, this doesn't hurt. He like puts up his elbow and then here, this doesn't hurt. He points. And then he points to his lips and then they kiss. Same thing, but it's flipped. And it ends with them kissing, and it's just...
That was perfect.
They really know how to play the hits.
Yeah, that was perfect.
Yeah, it got me.
I love seeing real old people flirt. It's amazing.
Dude, did you guys have the feeling when it zoomed out, it was a wide shot of them, the whole kitchen, and they were hugging? Like it was like a cute old romantic painting of old people in love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I would just they did a good job too of making his apartment feel like New York of that era.
Yeah.
And I really only know that era from other movies, really. But it was like nostalgic for something I literally never experienced, mm-hmm. but I was nostalgic because I saw that vibe in other movies.
Well, speaking of that, I should go into the real life facts. I'll mention that one first. That parade in New York, I don't know the exact date. I meant to look this up, but I ran out of time. That was an actual event, an actual parade celebrating the return of the astronauts from walking on the moon. Armstrong and Aldrin and everybody came through in a car in that parade in real life. We could look up that date if we feel like doing that, or patrons, you can hit us in the stream chat. I thought that was awesome. That
ticker tape parade down Broadway and Park Avenue. That looks right.
There you go.
I don't see a date though. It just says 13th of 1969, but it doesn't, or 15th of 1969, but it doesn't give me a month. So
one of the 15ths of the 12 months.
Yeah.
Febtoba.
Yeah. September.
I'm also seeing August 13th is a day for the ticker tape parade.
Okay.
For the Apollo 11. Yeah. August 13th.
There we go.
Coming up soon, the anniversary.
Oh, yeah. Let's have a parade.
What are you guys doing for the anniversary of the parade from 1969 on August 13th?
Come to your house, probably.
My birthday is this Sunday, so if you want me to just put off the party a couple days.
Yeah, we'll just sync, we can we'll party sync up here the events. You have to do that when you're older because lower energy. Yeah. All right. So the lance, the Holy Lance, the sort of misdirect artifact at the beginning in the prologue that Hitler's looking for. Not only was that lance used in Lawrence Kasdan's early Raiders drafts as the artifact pre-Ark of the Covenant, you know, being the official one that they went with, that's also an actual artifact that actual real-life Hitler searched for because he believed in its mythical power, or its purported mythical power. Like, who knows if there are real legends about it or not, but that was a real thing because that guy was crazy. The Archimedes heat ray that Indy's talking about in the lecture at the beginning, and then we see the sort of like bronze mirrors in that one tomb that are bouncing light around. So that was something that Archimedes actually designed, and it's with a bunch of his other writings, just like Da Vinci, things that people build periodically throughout history to try to recreate, like trebuchets and different things like this, that, you know, ancient weapons and machines. Supposedly, it was so powerful that it could just like burn the sails off of ships, burn holes in them, and it was used as a weapon. But Mythbusters actually did a whole ass episode on this and used all modern materials and like the best mirrors they could find, and it just doesn't work. So
maybe they had alien mirrors back then, though.
Very possible. But Indy wouldn't have seen Mythbusters in 1969 because I think Adam Savage was like 3 years old. What else? Well, first I'll say this. When Archimedes meets Indy, he sees the plane crash. One of the first things he says is Eureka, which supposedly is something that he really said when he really invented something back in the day. Again, I didn't finish doing my homework. This is probably legend. It's probably just like a thing he said here and there. It was, who knows, just one of those funny sayings, and it was attributed to a specific event or something that people said, and they just, you know, like every quote since the middle of the 19th century can be attributed to Mark Twain somehow. Probably a similar thing from 2,000 years ago, but nonetheless, that's where that comes from. The dial itself, the Antikythera, actually existed, at least a version of it. This is what it's called in real life, but it isn't, you know, it's been suggested, it's been hypothesized that it was something that Archimedes built. It is, if there's any truth to that, it's more likely, from what I've read, something that maybe just the school of people who he taught and the lessons that followed maybe created this machine, but it was dug up from a ship, barnacles all over it, all corroded and everything. And it appeared to be like the most complex machine that had been built or that would be built for another 1,000 years or something like that. Almost like a big watch with that kind of precision gear, calibrated kind of thing. What people can tell from doing different 3D scans of it and whatnot is that it seemed to track the movement of the stars and the moon and be able to predict the moving of the night sky. And it was kind of
eclipses is what I was seeing.
Yeah.
It would predict like when eclipses would happen.
So a real thing. Maybe Archimedes built it, maybe not.
What if, since it like predated any other machine for 1,000 years, what if it was used to go back in time?
I mean, maybe you should write a movie about
it. You know what I'm saying?
It's from the future.
What if the plot of the movie actually happened?
But it what?
Am I thinking of that correctly?
Yeah.
Well, let's get into the time travel stuff and what the implications are in a minute. There's one more thing. Last thing I'll say before we do that is Operation Paperclip, what I referenced earlier. Von Braun, other German scientists, Nazi scientists, who were basically given a pass in a way, sort of like when, you know, cops bring, or the FBI will bring in criminals to, you know, help them identify forgeries rather than busting them for forgeries or help solve crimes based on the kind of crimes that they had committed in the past. Similar thing, but with weapons technology, the rocket space program, even like some chemical weaponry, chemical warfare stuff. And this character, you know, played by Mads Mikkelsen, is kind of maybe an amalgam of several of those Nazis who actually were part of this Operation Paperclip. But I think the coolest part about this is just its proximity to the Oppenheimer film and how all that's tied together. Just really interesting that we just got like a 3-hour in-depth discussion of that in a film, and then we've got this right alongside it. It's pretty cool. Hey, everyone. We want to take a moment to tell you about the sponsor of this podcast, Roosevelt's.
You may know Roosevelt's as the company who makes those rad all-over print button-downs with just about every franchise that you love.
They, of course, have Star Wars, because this is a Star Wars podcast, but they also have Harry Potter, Disney, Pixar, Marvel, NASA, WWE, The Office, Nickelodeon, Rick and Morty, Friends, all kinds of other stuff, including new lines from Yellowstone and The Godfather.
And not just button-downs, but t-shirts, they do shorts, jackets, hoodies, koozies, flannels, so many different kinds of items, so many dope designs. So if you're interested in picking something up for the first time, go to rsvlts.com and use promo code THANKTHEMAKER with no spaces to get 20% off your first purchase. Once again, that's rsvlts.com. Use promo code THANKTHEMAKER to get 20% off of your first purchase.
All right, let's talk time travel. So there are a few ways to go about time travel in movies. The two biggest ones, without getting into like specific caveats and wild philosophies about, you know, plot devices about what does and doesn't affect the future when you go back in time and so on. It's basically like either you go back in time and when you make changes, it affects the future. Sometimes that gets into like an alternate universe thing, kind of like Back to the Future.
Mm-hmm.
Or you go full Terminator 1 route where what happens happened and it's all circular. Like the future is part of the past in this
it's
way.
It's already happened.
It already happened. Yeah. Like John Connor only exists because he sent the man who would become his father back to save his mother and impregnate her with him. Like a ridiculous paradox, but it's just like, you know, time and space are all one thing. There is no past and present because it all affects all of it kind of approach.
Yeah.
And that's what this one goes with, because we can talk specifics and try to like parse it out, but it seems as though Archimedes needed them to come back in time in order for him to have the knowledge or the frame of reference to actually finish the dial. Is that the way you guys read it as well?
I think so. If I'm following like the second version that we're talking about of time travel, there has to be like an initial time travel though for it to become circular, right?
I don't know. See, that's the thing.
It's hard to wrap your head around, but
yeah,
it's like a chicken and egg thing. There has to be an initial time travel.
There had to be a point where it didn't happen yet.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And we're just watching in entertainment we're watching the circle be a circle, but there has to be a first time.
Well, though. I guess that could be like a different version of it in a way.
Yeah, is that an alternate universe?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Like, is there one time that just happens?
Yeah, and it continues like spiraling and like...
But those different changes are a different...
And it keeps refining itself until mm-hmm. it gets more and more perfect. Like, there's a version where, I almost said Han Solo, where Indy does stay and fully gives him the dial and they sit there and work it out together. And, you know, if you went back to 1960, everybody be in Jetsons flying cars because of it. Or is this the only version because the illusion of linear time makes this impossible for to get our heads around? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It would be interesting to hear what the writers were really going for, or if they're going, yeah, whatever you guys think, you know?
Yeah.
It's a tough one. It's a tough one because I could see if he stayed there, then which version of time travel are they really going with? Because... technically, everything else that happened after that would have been altered.
But we don't...
So you kind of can't go that route,
but we don't know anything that happened in the Indiana Jones universe beyond that point unless you take the series as canon. Mm-hmm. So in theory, if he stayed back there with him, he was always meant to stay with him.
Yeah.
And he could have been, in some sense, necessary for history to play out that way. You know, like the watch, they find the watch.
Yeah.
In 1969, the Nazis' watch, Mad Nicholson's watch, mm-hmm. on Archimedes' wrist in the tomb.
Yeah,
we see the bust on the side of the tomb with the phoenix, right? It's a phoenix with propellers on it. You know?
Yeah.
And the idea is that he didn't know it, but he designed this thing to bring whoever was going to find it straight back to that point in time because he needed them to. Mm-hmm. He has this like ultimately like this Doc Brown moment when Indy shows up like, it works. Finally, I invented something that works. Like there's no question about what he's seeing other than what specific time did you come from. He just knows like these are people from the future. I did it. You mm-hmm. know, mm-hmm. good night, future boy, you know.
For, I don't know if you guys thought this for like 2 or 3 seconds, but when they opened Archimedes' tomb and the watch was on the wrist, for some reason, my brain went to, that's Indy's bones.
Yes, 100%.
You did? Okay. I was like,
you're talking about his dad's watch and everything, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Or was it Basil's watch? Either way. Yeah, I thought that. And I wonder if that if there was a version of the plot and the ending that like maybe there were two different versions of that line in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would have been on board for that.
Could be. I would be on board for him staying. It's just, again, it's execution. It's how you do it. Because I think that the real issue with Kingdom of the Crystal Skull is like, I honestly think if you write down on paper how that movie ends, I'd be like, that's pretty dope.
Yeah.
Interdimensional aliens. I kind of dig that. But it was just kind of how it went, you know, like how it went down and how it looked, which was more so the issue.
A little too ambitious with the CG.
Yeah. Because I dig that.
Yeah.
That's a great idea. My issues... If I can name one issue with Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, it's Mutt swinging through that jungle.
Playing like Tarzan. Donkey Kong?
That's just... Yeah, I'm good. I don't need that.
That's always the clip, you see.
Yeah. So I would love to know if there was a crazier ending and if they pulled it off, but they didn't... They thought it was too crazy. If they felt like they didn't pull it off, so they didn't do it. Because it definitely was a safer ending, and you can't ignore Helena punching him out and the screen going black, and then they're back in New York. I'm like, that's literally insert a new ending right here.
Yeah. There's an article that I sent you guys. Did you see it here?
I didn't get to
see it. I didn't open it yet.
See it.
So
the alternate ending.
Alleged alternate ending. Let's try to look through this quickly and then get to the end of this. This comes courtesy of Scooper, WDW Pro, Walt Disney World, I assume. Separate from a different rumor about Phoebe Waller-Bridge to replace Indy, we'll talk about that. Been told that Bridge put on the hat in every ending in that rumor. Okay. Indiana Jones was going to be lying on the grass with Archimedes there, but he was going to convince Phoebe Waller-Bridge to leave him there and save Teddy and the others and go back through time. They could not take him with them, and he would give her his hat. Tell her it's time for her adventures, yada, yada, yada. She and Teddy and the other gentlemen then attempt to escape through a very significant action sequence, and they go through a time rift. And then you find that after she's gone back to the original date, she would have learned learned a lesson in the final scene where she's no longer out to make money off all these artifacts, but instead working to get them into museums where they belong. Hmm. Okay. Then there was going to be a second appearance where, after all that fades out, Indiana Jones is back with Archimedes in the past, and it turns out that he had a clever plan the entire time. And it was that he tells Archimedes that he will explain the Dial of Destiny to him and tell him all kinds of secrets only if he writes one special message on there. And he has him do it in a language that Indy knows. The message is something to the effect of, tell her you love her and tell him he'll die if he goes to war. Mm. Hmm. And then it was going to go for the very last scene to tell Indy when he takes the Dial of Destiny from Basil. It goes to where Indy takes the Dial of Destiny away from him when he's supposed to destroy it. And then he sees the message in a language that he understands and gets kind of wide-eyed and shocked. And that was going to end the film. This WDW Pro finished. It left the audience hanging as to whether or not he was successful in saving his marriage and Mutt based on the message that was sent. Hmm. Interesting.
It's too vague, I feel like. Too vague of an ending.
Yeah.
There needed to be some finality to it. I mean, whether or not, I don't know if this is a good way to do things, whether or not Phoebe is getting a series, a movie, if she's picking things up and is new, like Indiana Jones, for lack of a better term, that's all cool with me. But if the movie ended, like this article says, where with her with the whip and the hat on and I'm going on adventures, there would be an uproar.
It's too much too soon, presuming too much in a way, right?
Exactly. So it's kind of, you kind of get the sense that it's a big possibility. I mean, maybe if the movie did better, it'd be an even higher percentage possibility that she could continue the story. But I'm glad they didn't kind of ham-fist it in there. Because if she just shows up in a couple of years, there's a new movie, call it whatever you want to call it, and it's in the indie verse, cool, I'll go see it.
Yeah, let's pose the question a little more specifically, I guess, to Dano. Nick, you kind of already answered. Mm-hmm. How would you feel, / would you watch a new series of films, or one, or a series, you know, like a TV series centered around Phoebe Waller-Bridge as sort of like a spiritual successor to Indiana Jones? It doesn't even have to be called Indiana Jones.
If it was a film, I would definitely watch it in theaters. I'd give the first one, you know, a shot and see how it goes. If it was a show, if it was a series, it would be a little bit harder to get me to commit to setting aside time watching it. I feel like a movie, if they're going to go that route and spend that money to make a feature film, they might put a little bit more love into it. And I don't know, you know, if it's a series, it's going to be what, a Disney Plus series?
Right.
And I don't know how I feel about that right now. Like,
there's no money in streaming.
Yeah.
We're learning that.
Yeah. So if it was a film, yes. If it was a series, I would probably check out the first episode, but I don't know that I would stay up till midnight to watch it. You know, I wouldn't make a big deal out of it, but I would probably catch it within the week that it came out and give it a shot. Similar to like Marvel just had that, whatever the new one was with Samuel L. Jackson. I watched
Secret Invasion.
I watched one episode and I was like, okay, this should be good. And I was just like, yeah, no, these shows are losing me slowly. And I used to catch every Marvel movie when it came out. You know, it's just something about the shows is leaving a weird taste in my mouth. We were talking earlier about how Kingdom of the Skull kind of maybe left that for the general audience. When it comes to series, especially done by Disney, they're kind of leaving me with a weird taste in their mouth. Other than Star Wars, Star Wars stuff I keep showing up to, and right, I keep loving it. But anything non-Star Wars, I tend to just kind of be okay about. So film, yes. Show, eh.
That's fair.
Yeah, interesting. Because I feel like there's the terminology of like, we're going to do a slowdown with Star Wars, and now Marvel looks like it's going that way. I'm like, what is going on?
Yeah,
it's like too much and not good quality. Like, why everything just needs to be slowed down? Like, it's our fault,
right?
We're not.
Yeah,
we're like, no, it's too much stuff we're putting out. The people don't want it. It's like, well, make better stuff. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah. Oh, whoa. So, Jason Chiodo, friend of the pod. Mosh Eisley accomplice, just said in the chat, he said he's pretty sure that Phoebe Waller-Bridge has been tapped to play Lara Croft already.
Oh,
well,
interesting.
So, I mean, if she's...
Is that like the third Lara Croft of our lifetime? At least,
that was the third, yeah.
I mean, if she's co-writing and producing, sign me up. I will take that as the, like, spiritual successor to Indy. You know, like the unofficial sequel.
I don't know that I like her as Lara Croft, though.
Yeah.
You know, I like her, and I like her character in Indy as Wombat. I think she's great as that, like, kind of sass mouth character. That's what she plays best, right? L337 is very similar.
Yeah.
Which was awesome to have the Falcon, technically, and Harrison Ford in the same movie. But I don't know that I like her as Lara Croft. Lara Croft isn't a sass mouth like that.
Yeah, not snarky.
Yeah. I like her for what she is, but I don't know if I like her for Lara Croft.
But do you like Lara Croft in the game, or do you actually like the films?
I mean, my Tomb Raider experience was 1 and 2, and there wasn't a whole lot of talking.
Yeah.
You know, it was like still PlayStation 1.
Yeah.
Generic, like, polygon boobies kind of thing. Like, it was, you know, so there wasn't a whole lot of dialogue or a whole lot to like other than, you know, that.
Just but aesthetics,
I guess, for what they were, as blocky as they were. It was more just the puzzle solving and adventure. But I feel like that character wasn't a fast, witty, smart mouth like Phoebe Waller-Bridge is in it, pretty much everything she's in. And I love her for that. I think that's where she does really well, is being snarky like that. And I don't know. I don't get that vibe from Lara Croft.
Here's a question, though.
Lara Croft is very much indie, right? So
yeah, and the
it works.
And the Tomb Raider movies haven't been great. They've been met with a lot of criticism. They haven't done super well. And it seems like one of the big criticisms is they tried to lean on the fact that Angelina Jolie is just cool and just looks cool and just like brings like a presence, but it was lacking in actual character depth, probably because the source material just didn't have a lot. So they either had to create it or lean on a star. They didn't create it. The reboot more recently, I don't know what happened with that.
I didn't
get much acclaim, so.
No.
I enjoyed it.
It looked good.
You know,
I thought it looked great.
Yeah.
But I never actually watched it, so.
Whatever, I'm looking up her name, Alicia Vikander. I mean, thought she did great, yeah.
Well, I mean, I feel like if anybody can sort of, if you can adapt a game to a movie and add elements that weren't part of the game that you need to make a film work, I would be down. Granted, I didn't play the shit out of it, but I would be down to get on that ride with them and get the Phoebe Waller-Bridge interpretation.
Sure.
I would go for that.
I might give it a shot, yeah.
Or even if it was officially indie, like, call it whatever, call it something else.
Yeah.
You know.
I'd rather it be indie than Tomb Raider.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, because I feel like there's obviously some value if you somehow get to name it or say it's in the Indiana Jones universe. Because don't you think that between like whatever movie The Rock is doing or National Treasure, the Mummy, I guess it was, right? With Brendan Fraser. Those are all Indiana Jones ripoffs. And they all actually were fairly successful too. So, you could kind of go your own route and just have this Indiana Jones-esque franchise, and maybe it goes here. If you think saying that it's in the Indiana Jones universe, it gives it a little bit extra oomph, maybe go for it. I just don't know. There's no like other characters to bring in. Everyone was like such an old person in this movie besides Phoebe Waller and Teddy. It's like you really only have those two characters and we're not attached to them yet.
You got Short Round though.
Yeah, Short Round could come back.
That was the one old character I would have liked to have seen in this movie. You know, we got Sala, we got Marion, but like, I really would have liked to have seen Short Round make.
I bet you nobody knew he was making a comeback.
Nobody knew.
Like, Indiana Jones was fully in production while Everything Everywhere All at Once came out.
There were big rumors that he was coming back when Spielberg was still attached as the director. Mm-hmm. So maybe there was a version, but I mean, I know I would go watch that absolutely on release night, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. If it was anyone else, I would be very skeptical, but she's just so good, and she just absolutely killed in this movie.
Yeah, she's great.
I think it's worth the risk. Think about all the other risks they're taking. Like, think about all the animated to live action adaptations they're doing that are just bombing. I don't know. I don't think you can put the indie name straight on it, but I don't know.
How do you say, besides in like a press clip, like, this is set in the Indiana Jones universe, like, how do you make it besides
it would just be the press, it would be exactly
the
that
font, you know, the same gradient font or something,
Fedora font or whatever. It would have to be like that, like similar branding, and in the press, make sure all everyone, Entertainment Tonight or whoever, like, reports it as, ooh, an Indiana Jones project.
Yeah.
Yeah, or, like, she has to get the Sankara stones, you know, like, just reboot, redo a
little
movie
or something. Like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, the occasional cameo. That could be interesting. But it would have to be very indie. It would have to be that very, like, kind of campy.
Indie. You know,
there'd have to be Nazis at some point.
Yeah.
And a little bit of that weird supernatural.
Yeah.
Element too, which I don't really feel like that's as much of a Tomb Raider kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I don't see the supernatural kind of crazy stuff happening as much as you do in.
And it's just also because indie has always been on a timeline. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's gonna the next story. If she was, you know, in a movie, would be in the 70s, and you just start dealing with like too much technology. I feel like at that point to have this archaeological thing going on. I mean, I'm oversimplifying it, but I think the more technology there is in the real world in Indiana Jones, it probably becomes a little harder to tell a cool story.
Well, figure you've got 30 years before it starts to get goofy with, you know, 90s tech.
Internet.
70s and 80s could still be fun. You like think about the Cold War. There could be the shift to like the Russians. Like I was thinking about stories you could tell. You'd have to skip a movie because we do Nazis every other movie, not every movie. I mean, I guess there are Nazis in the last one too, but.
The aliens or Nazis?
The, what's her name?
In Kingdom of the Crystal Skull?
And they're real. The government confirmed they're real.
You know, the Nazis hiding in Argentina, right? Mm. In the 50s, you could go do some great South American mythology and get involved with Nazis down there. Just keep killing them. We all love to punch Nazis and to watch them get punched.
It, you know, a franchise like Bond has been able to survive the decades.
Yeah.
So, you know, it could be done. It would get a little weird. Like you're saying, the technology makes it weird because it's Indiana Jones, but it could be done. There are ways to tell stories that keep it going.
They made a good point on the rewatchables when they were doing Last Crusade, which I fully back. These movies were so good in the 80s. They could have done a dozen of them.
Oh, yeah.
It could have been serial style, and they all would have been fun. Who knows if Harrison Ford would have been on board. Maybe that's part of it. Spielberg also had other ambitions. He was trying to make, you know, he got to the place where he wanted to make the Schindler's List type films, and, you know, all those are factors, but they very well could have gone the Bond route, which was, like, the original idea. Lucas wanted to make a Bond film. He couldn't get the rights. He couldn't get put in position to do that, so he said, well, let's do, like, mash up, what was the old one? There's like some shot-for-shot stuff with Coming Out of Tombs, like an old character from the old serials. It's like that and Bond that they mashed up. So I'm sure there were discussions of like, how many of these do we do?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So here we are. Nonetheless, great movie. I'll take the 5. Crystal Skull's not even nearly as, I don't want to say, how do I flip this? It's better than I remember it.
Halfway.
It's not that bad. Like it gets a lot of hate. It really does, but I don't think it's that bad. I still enjoy it for what it is.
I remember watching it during the pandemic and was like halfway through and was like, wait, am I insane? This movie's good. And then the swinging from the trees. Just everything after that's not good. And again, fully on board with aliens wanting knowledge and interdimensional aliens wanting knowledge. Amazing. Love that. But
execution. You got to that part in the movie and you were like in Pineapple Express when he's on the phone with his girlfriend and she says, I love you or let's get married or whatever. And he goes, this was a mistake.
Yeah.
This was a mistake. I'm realizing now what I've done. Yeah. All right. Let's wrap this thing up with I love you. I know.
I love you.
I know.
Perfect Han Solo drop. Perfect. All right. Let's go to the patrons and get their Indiana Jones ranking. I had some favorite quotes in here and stuff, but I don't know. I can't do them word for word, even though I recorded the audio when I was in there on my voice memos. I didn't take the time to pull the quotes. So we'll just go with
FBI.
Our rankings in order of the Indiana Jones films, the 5 films. Nick, Dano, one of you guys want to read from the stream chat channel in Discord? And
you want me to read these? I could read them.
Go in order. Do SoCal Bat. He did his ranking and then put a comment a few down below that.
Yep. Ethan, SoCal Bat 2 says, number 1, Raiders. Number 2, Last Crusade. Number 3, Temple of Doom. 4, Dial of Destiny. 5, Crystal Skull.
All right.
Close for me.
That's very close for me, too. That's almost just one swapped.
Okay, so Ethan's comment, I maintain my earlier Dial of Destiny review. I enjoy it. Loved watching Harrison Ford swing for the fences emotionally as an aged indie, and Mangold did a totally serviceable job, but you can't replace Spielberg's visible storytelling style. Missing that made it lose a bit of wonder and charm.
All right. Valid.
Yeah.
I mean, Mangold did really go for a few of those signature things, but there's only one Spielberg.
Yeah, that's the point I was going to make. I was like, I think he just did some Spielberg stuff, as you should if you're doing an Indy 5, but...
There can be only one.
The Blue Guy 808, Dial of Destiny number one.
Damn.
Crazy.
Bold.
Right. Last Crusade 2, Temple of Doom 3, Raiders 4, Crystal Skull 5.
Interesting. Raiders 4th. Whoa, that is bold.
Yeah.
The Blue Guy 808, can we ask how old you are and how old you were when you first saw and which film you saw first?
That's the most important, which you saw first.
Yeah. Mm. Let's read Chuck's and then see if the Blue Guy responds.
Chuck Living, Raiders 1, Last Crusade 2, Crystal Skull 3, Temple of Doom 4, Dial of Destiny 5.
Chuck.
Okay.
These are all great.
Love the variety.
But Chuck Living does say, for me, Crystal Skull holds a special place as it was the first indie I got to see in theaters. So
that's totally important. Yeah. The first one you see definitely leaves a big mark on you. Mm-hmm. So,
and Chuck is 35, so... Yep, that would have been the only opportunity.
Yeah, in theaters, yeah.
Yeah, not even...
I mean, unless you did some of those weird screenings, like I got to see a couple of those.
Oh, yeah.
I think
yeah.
I've seen them all in theaters at, like, midnight screenings at weird, you know.
The first outing during COVID where my local independent theater was doing pop-up, like, drive-in movies was Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Nice.
It was a very good vibe.
That's sick. I saw Raiders on the anniversary screening recently. Did I talk about that on the pod?
I think so. You did. Yeah. Yes.
It was dope. It was really, really dope. But I'll save my comments for my ranking. Who wants to go next, Nick or Dano?
I can do mine. I'll get mine out of the way here.
Go for it.
So for me, number one is Raiders. It's Raiders. Come on. It's like the iconic, just the intro is Indiana Jones. Two would be Temple of Doom. First one I ever saw. So there you go. Three, Last Crusade. It's Last Crusade. Four, Dial of Destiny. And then five, Crystal Skull.
Mm-hmm. Repeat that one more time.
Okay. Raiders, Temple of Doom number two, Last Crusade number three. So really in order. And then Dial of Destiny, I liked more than I liked Crystal Skull.
This is so much fun. I love these are I feel like these are all gonna be so different. Any other further thoughts? Are you good?
No, I'm good. Go for it.
Nick, hit it.
Gali Ma Shati Day, Temple of Doom number one.
Whoa.
Crusade number two, Raiders three. Dial of Destiny 4, Crystal Skull. I like Aliens, man, but it was, you know.
Yeah.
It was kind of one of those things where you knew it was in trouble right away. Because, like, the gopher popped up or whatever it was. And I'm just like, oh.
But in defense, there's so much stuff that's just as stupid and goofy in the old, like, and that's one of the things I noticed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, everything about it. And Mangold even talked about in this movie, bringing back a lot of that stuff, but just watering it down a little bit, like the over-the-top ridiculous sounds of the punches and like the choreography of the fights and all like the slapstick kind of stuff, you know, even with like Mads getting hit with the, with whatever, the sign thing on the train, just like a cartoon, you know?
Yeah.
So.
That should have decapitated him. And I don't even know if he had a scar.
Yeah. I had some similar feelings with Crystal Skull where I was like, is this too far? But I was like, okay, it's fine.
It was like too far, like right away, kind of.
Yeah.
Him going in and being blown up.
Yes.
In the refrigerator.
Yeah. They nuked the fridge.
Yeah. So pretty silly, but.
Someone should do a dissertation about George Lucas, like how amazing it is that he pushed technology forward. But then when he used it, it was like,
Yeah.
We needed you to invent the technology and filmmaking and CGI and all this stuff, but your ideas.
Pump the brakes next time. All right. So before I give mine, the Blue Guy 808 has responded. He says he was so young, he doesn't remember which one he watched first. He just remembers liking or not liking Temple that much because it scared him as a kid. Makes sense.
That's scary. What I've heard a lot. Like when people rate these things,
Golly,
and they say Raiders more, they said Temple of Doom was scary. I'm a baby, and it didn't scare me.
I loved it.
Things scare the shit out of me.
I loved how scary it was as a kid. Like I liked like being freaked out in my parents' room. A, freaked out because they were going to catch me watching it, and then B, freaked out because the movie was like scary. Like I loved it.
But he says that the reason Temple is higher than Raiders, like we said, what about it's 100% short round carrying that movie. He said he's absolutely the best part of that movie, and it feels like an understatement. I mean, same. I think
he had such good lines, like "No Time for Love, Dr. Jones," like all that kind of stuff. Like, yeah, he had the best lines.
They had the best chemistry, the two of them. So
yeah.
All right, my ranking. This is so sick. Literally every one of us has a different ranking. I love this. So my number one is without a doubt The Last Crusade. I know there's some nostalgia bias, but I also think the type of story it is, it's a little more mature. It has all the stupid, goofy, campy adventure stuff of Raiders, but it has the father-son dynamic, which is part of all my favorite stuff. Star Wars, even Back to the Future, Doc Brown is like a father figure, you know? So I love it, and I just, you know, there's some weak characters, but the father-son dynamic is, again, chemistry, such a key part of it. It's so good. And the puzzle-solving stuff, and just like the little bit of like added maturity of Spielberg as a filmmaker, and the sophistication of the cinematography and everything else, you can see he's like just fully at the peak of his powers when he makes that. And it's also the one I rewatch the most, so I know there's some bias, but that's my number one. Number two is Raiders. Close second for what it is. It's amazing. I feel like I actually have seen Temple of Doom maybe more times, just because I think my dad watched it a lot and he loved that voodoo shit. He just thought it was just like, look at the heart. That's great. You know? So I was probably just exposed to it more. But yeah, Raiders is second. And I'm going to be bold and say Dial of Destiny. I know there's some recency bias here, but I think Dial of Destiny is my number three, followed by Temple of the Doom. And then, did I say Temple of the Doom? Temple of Doom.
Yes.
Temple of the Doom. That was a band name that didn't pass in the 90s because Temple of the Dog came out and they couldn't have done that. Temple of Doom. And then last, of course, I'm sorry, Crystal Skull. Still fun. Again, I still like it more than I did when I originally saw it, but something has to go last. So that's where that goes.
Yeah.
And that wraps up our Indiana Jones first ever non-Star Wars film breakdown and review. Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. Love it.
We did it.
We did it. All right. We announced recently that we are bringing Mosh Eisley back before the end of the year. We're doing New York Comic Con.
Late night.
I won't repeat the date or the venue because there are some things that we're still talking about. So there's a lot of agreement, a lot of disagreement, a lot of stress. I'm on the stress end. I will take responsibility for all the turmoil in the chat right now. but we're figuring out. We're doing it. It's happening the weekend of New York Comic Con in New York City, somewhere in Manhattan, somewhere in an expensive neighborhood with $400 hotels and all the good stuff. We're going to party.
Rats. Definitely a lot of rats.
Pizza.
Rats.
Turtles. Mutant turtles.
I think I'm going to go see that right now, actually.
Oh, dude. It looks good.
Like, I'm going to look up, as soon as we're done, I'm going to look up tickets and see if I can go see it tonight. I
haven't seen Barbie yet.
Do it.
Yeah. Sounds great.
I'm going to see it again.
It's good.
All right. Dano or Nick, anything non-this related, non-Mosh you want to shout out before we go?
It's my birthday Sunday.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Happy pre-birthday.
Are you partying?
Not really. I mean, I've been to Galaxy's Edge, I think, every year since it's opened on my birthday. So I'll spend a couple hours there, most likely in the morning. Other than that, I got like kind of like a staycation vibe. You know, like I went on Resort Pass and got a cabana at a hotel nearby.
Nice.
So that's it.
Very cool.
Dano?
Watch parties. Ahsoka's coming out very soon in about 3 weeks. So every Tuesday night, starting at 11. Right now I'm doing them at 10:30 because the shows aren't out yet, but it'll be 11 when Ahsoka's on. Come hang out at youtube.com/thedanochannel every Tuesday night, 11 p.m., an hour before Ahsoka drops. We can hang out together, talk about it, get excited, watch together, and then hang out afterwards and talk about what we just saw.
I show up sometimes.
Fun. Yeah.
Maybe I'll get a wild hair and be up late and do that with you in my time zone. Maybe not.
Yeah, it'd be awesome.
But we'll be covering those day of or night of Wednesday nights when those are dropping and doing the same kind of stream thing. and I'll be stressing out all day trying to prepare notes and overdoing it and having OCD and ADHD at the same time, as is tradition. Patrons, thanks for being here. You guys make this possible. New patrons, old patrons, everyone, we love you so much. If you want to be a patron, listener, viewer, patreon.com/thankthemakerpod is where you can go. Get exclusive content, an ad-free podcast fee, exclusive merch. You get priority in the Discord chat here. As you can see, we're referencing this specifically. We're not even really keeping up with the YouTube chat. Sorry, that's the way it works. That's how we pay the bills. We appreciate you guys. Everyone, thanks for listening and watching. Follow us on socials. All that's in the show notes. And until next week, may the Force be with you. If you enjoy Thank the Maker, you can support us by following and leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Or you can support us directly at patreon.com/thankthemakerpod, where you can get access to our Discord server, exclusive content, exclusive merch, our recording live stream, and more. Our patrons quite literally make Thank the Maker possible.